One of the greatest threats to Earth's biodiversity is habitat fragmentation. From development, including housing and roadways, to agriculture, human impact on the ecosystem is the number one driver of species extinctions. But with some help, nature can adapt to our alterations. A team of scientists has spent nearly two decades studying fragmented sections of longleaf pine savanna habitat in South Carolina. Over 18 years, they've collected small restored patches of the savanna to one another via habitat corridors. Their efforts have brought encouraging results, including an annual increase in the number of plant species in each piece of habitat. The study's lead author is UW-Madison conservation biologist Ellen Domshin. She spoke with LakeFX's Susan Benz about this new strategy to conserve plant and animal species and her own unexpected path to science.
Okay, the beginning is that I was a musician, and I was in college, and I went to a small liberal arts college, Luther College in Decorah, Iowa, and I was a music and communication major. And my last semester of my senior year, I took a course in environmental ethics, and that course really made me think for the first time about issues related to biodiversity, what was happening in the world, and then also what that meant for people. And it fascinated me. And I also recognized that my whole life, one of the things I enjoyed the most was spending time in nature. And so I combined sort of a curiosity and inquisitiveness that's also a part of my personality, along with thinking about this problem and wanting to solve it and enjoying doing it at the same time. So I went back to school and got coursework in ecology, all of the things that I needed to go to graduate school. And then I also had an internship at Cedar Creek Natural History Area, which is in Minnesota. It's one of their field stations with the university. And while I was there, I met a postdoc named Nick Haddad, who is also on this paper. And he had just gotten his first faculty job in North Carolina at North Carolina State and was about ready to launch this habitat fragmentation study. And at one of the lunches, we had talks every Wednesday when we were interns. He gave a seminar about this vision based on a study that they had just completed at the Savannah River site. And I was immediately captured because it was this combination of asking really important theoretically based questions in ecology about why space matters for the number of species that you see, that had also this other side of real applied relevance that managers could use on the ground. Long story short, I ended up starting graduate school with him the following fall. And I was a plant person and he was a butterfly person. And so we were both interested in diversity. And so I kind of brought the plant angle to the system and just started counting the number of plant species that we saw as soon as the experiment was set up. And now, actually 20 years later, we just collected our 20th year of data this last summer. We're able to ask these amazing long-term questions about how space affects the number of species that you see for plants.
Amazing. And there you have the story.
And there you have the story.
That's amazing. So he had the structure of the study in place.
As a PhD student himself, he had set up a precursor to the study where it was just squares of habitat that were connected or not by corridors of different lengths. And some of the people that had worked on that project, there was someone working on butterflies, which was Nick Haddad, and then someone working on birds, Doug Levy, who's also on this paper, someone at the time who was working on small mammals, Brent Danielson, Sarah Sargent was another person. And so they took what they had learned from that study and then helped design the new study with funding from the National Science Foundation and then also a huge amount of support from the U.S. Forest Service and Department of Energy at Savannah River site. Without them, this would never have happened. So a lot of us then, you know, we're excited about this as graduate students and postdocs joining in this project, and we kind of got in on the ground floor as it was getting set up.
Oh, super. So we're talking about this remnant savanna, or is it oak savanna or pine savanna?
South Carolina, it's pine, longleaf pine savanna, and it is a habitat that once extended from Texas all the way through the Gulf, through Florida, and then all the way up into southern Virginia. So it was extensive across the southeastern United States.
So like 90 million acres, right?
Yeah. And there's less than 3% of the original habitat remaining, meaning that it was not put, you know, turned over by a plow or completely converted to agriculture. And then the rest of it is being restored. And there are little bits here and there that were not plowed under, but then they were typically fire suppressed, meaning that fire was not able to return at the normal interval that it had historically, which is about every 1 to 5 years. And it has a lot of similarities to other grassland and savanna ecosystems across the world. Most of these savanna and grassland communities are maintained with frequent low-intensity fire, which is very different from other ecosystems where we hear a lot about fire. I think a lot of our cultural vision of what fire is for natural ecosystems comes from the American West. And that's a very different disturbance regime where you have a huge stand-replacing high-intensity fire that happens on the order of hundreds of years. And the fire regime in the southeastern United States and for many other grassland and savanna ecosystems like tallgrass prairie and oak savanna here in Wisconsin would be a low-intensity fire that just burns through the understory. The canopy trees remain and survive, and those fires happen every 1 to 5 years. So it's a very different kind of ecosystem.
Right. So, Ellen, what you had there, or have there, because it's still, research continues, right, is like two football field-sized fragments of habitat, right?
Right.
And then those connecting corridors, were those created through the study, or did they remain as well?
No. So the entire study was created from scratch. So what was there before was pine plantation, which is a very densely planted forest that has pine trees planted, and the understory is pretty depauperate. There's not a lot going on. Pine needles tend to accumulate on the forest floor, and so it's not as diverse as a savanna. So then what we did is we created these openings. There's in the center, there's a square opening, and then it's connected to another square by a 150-meter long, 25-meter wide corridor that's also the savanna habitat. And then we have a couple other patch types that are unconnected, but are the same amount of area as the connected patch plus the corridor. And those two allow us to understand how corridors work, because it could be just that you end up with more habitat when you add a corridor, and really the driving factor for why you would see more species is just that you have more area of habitat. And so what we did to control for that is create a rectangle where we have a square habitat patch with the area of the corridor added on the back of it to make a rectangle, but it's unconnected. So we can compare what's happening in that rectangle to what's happening in a connected patch, and we know that if something different is happening in the connected patch, it's not due to area alone. Okay. And then we also have one other patch type, which is taking the corridor and chopping it in half and then making these two, they look like wings on either side of the square. It's also the same area, and it has approximately the same amount of edge habitat relative to core. And that's important to control for, because when you fragment habitat, you end up with a lot more edginess in the landscape. It's not just one habitat type continuously. It breaks up and becomes something else, and so you end up with these boundaries between habitats. And those are thought to drive a lot of responses. So it's a well-controlled study.
I can tell. So I have to go back to an elegant word you used, which was depauperate.
Depauperate means that there would be, first of all, low numbers of plants in the understory. You wouldn't see a lot of plants, and then also lower numbers of species of plants. So there's, if you looked at the forest structure, the savanna structure, in a pine savanna, you might see, a handful of plants from a handful of species. But if you go to a savanna where it's frequently burned and the trees are much more sparse and it's being maintained with fire, you would see many, many more species, and also this rich carpet of grasses and flowering plants that are able to grow because they have enough light and less competition from the trees.
So as the study began, it was the process of identifying and setting aside these parcels, but then restoring them to, or trying
Correct.
To bring them back to its pre-European impact.
Right. And I actually think now, it wasn't the intent to have this come out at a moment like this 20 years ago when the study started, but we have just heard so much about, just in the past couple of weeks, we've heard about the declines in biodiversity In birds, for example, 3 billion birds have been lost, and the biggest impacts are actually from grassland ecosystems. And so what do you do about that when there is so little grassland or savanna habitat remaining? In Wisconsin, it's less than either 3% or 1% of the habitat type originally, depending on which, you know, subtype of grassland or savanna you're talking about. So there's not much left. So now we know that restoration plays a key role in conservation, and especially for grassland and savanna ecosystems. And so our study actually mimics what you would do by recreating this habitat and reinserting fire into the landscape and having these routine fires, and then watching how connectivity might alter the end state. And so, yes, this is definitely a restoration study and a study in progress.
So how long was it before you began to see that increase in number of plant and animal species?
You know, we actually saw it happen quite quickly. My dissertation ended by publishing a paper showing that corridors worked. And so that was in 2006. And we saw these plant species increasing in numbers quite rapidly. And then this study emerged because we wondered, well, how long will this last? It must not be able to last forever. And so we put together this proposal that, okay, like, what are the predictions we'd make? And what we've seen as a result that came out of this paper is actually the least likely outcome that we predicted ahead of time. So the fact that it's continued to operate the way that it has been really surprising.
So you're talking about, what is it, a 5% annual increase in species?
Correct.
Right?
Right. So it's the numbers sound small when you read it at first, but
not to me.
Well, good, because the way to think about it is sort of like your bank account, where if you put your money in maybe your checking account, you're going to get some rate of interest that's not very great. It's going to be, I don't know, 1% or less. And so you might think about, okay, well, maybe I should move it to a money market or a different kind of account because I'm going to get 2, 3, 4, 5% return each year on my investment. And that's exactly the way to think about these numbers. So what we found was that on an annual basis, the likelihood of any species arriving for the first time, so we call that colonization, was 5% higher in a connected patch than in one that did not have a corridor. And the flip side of that is that for any given species, the likelihood of blinking out or going extinct in any given habitat patch was 2% lower when it was connected by a corridor than compared to when it did not have that. And so that has compounded those rates every year for every species over time. And now we have 14% more species in the connected patches than the unconnected patches on average. And that equates to about 24 species per patch in a connected patch, more than an unconnected patch.
Talk about some of those species that have...
Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting because if you know your prairie and oak savanna species at all here in Wisconsin, you will know a lot of them in longleaf. It's the same dominant plant families. So there's a lot from the grass family, a lot from the aster family, and a lot from the bean family. And the ecosystem is very diverse. Prairies and oak savannas are very diverse, and longleaf is incredibly diverse. So some of my favorite species are a species called catbells is the common name. It's Baptisia perfoliata. The reason it's called perfoliata is because the leaf is perfoliate, meaning that the stem goes straight through the middle of a circle. So it's a circle with a stem going right through the middle of it, and there's no indentation or anything. And it has yellow flowers. It's in the bean family, and it has these pods that explode and let their seeds disperse that way. That's one of my favorites. There's also others from the Euphorbiaceae family that have sort of a thick, milky sap, and that family is the same family that poinsettias are from. And so they have very kind of like interesting leaves, and the seeds are in sets of three, so the pods look quite interesting. There's a lot of really neat plants. And then the animals are really amazing as well. A species that we've worked on is the common buckeye, which is a butterfly that's actually found here as well. It's brown with kind of a, looks like an eye that's pastel colors, pink and blue and purple on the wings. And then there's some amazing animals, including the gopher tortoise, which is a land tortoise that creates burrows in the soil, and then an associated snake that uses those burrows for its own habitat called the indigo snake, and then an endangered species of woodpecker called the red-cockaded woodpecker that creates nests inside of mature longleaf pine trees. So they have to be a certain age before they can excavate this cavity. And that's one of the reasons that they ended up on the endangered species list. But they're recovering quite well and are really an interesting kind of bird.
So what's the next step in this work for you?
Yeah, well, I mean, we are in year six of a 10-year grant from the National Science Foundation where we're going to continue to monitor these rates over time. And like I said, we were really surprised by this effect continuing each year. And so maybe we will continue to see that for the next, you know, through the next decade. But we don't know. And then I think we also are really interested in some of both the broader implications and then also some of the mechanisms. So starting with the mechanisms, you know, why is it that these 5% increases each year in colonization rates occur? Is it something about where the way the plant moves or the way it establishes by seed in the patches? And we can do some more detailed studies to get at that. And then on the broader end, there are a lot of associated benefits, like, for example, ecosystem services is a word that we sometimes use to just mean the benefits that nature provides for people. And for example, we could look at plant-pollinator interactions, or we could look at soil productivity and soil rejuvenation as an ecosystem service. And so I think that maybe thinking about how these changes in biodiversity and the number of species might then translate to increased ecosystem services might be a future direction as well.
Ellen Domshin is professor in the Department of Integrative Biology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. She is the lead author of Ongoing Accumulation of Plant Diversity Through Habitat Connectivity in an 18-Year Experiment, which was published last week in Science. You'll find more information, including a graphic comic created to describe the study, at wuwm.com.